Welcome to the Should Have Bet More podcast presented by VSiN, the Sports Betting Network. Coming up on the show, Jensen Lewis, former Major League pitcher and host of VSiN by the Books, will join us. We'll go over Major League Baseball, his favorite win totals, awards, maybe some WBC. Do a little story time with him. I talk to him often enough. I don't think we spend enough time talking about what it was like facing A-Rod and David Ortiz and Manny Ramirez and Jeter and all these guys. And we'll get into a little story time with Jensen, but we'll start with some college hoops, keeping the countdown to March going, and just a couple days away, Sunday, March 1st. So Saturday at midnight, you can turn that calendar to March, and that means the conference tournaments follow right after that. One of them starts on Monday. That's the Horizon, which is Monday, March 2nd, and then two more start on Tuesday. That is the Sun Belt and the Patriot League. And then by Wednesday, you've got Ohio Valley, you've got Big South, you've got Atlantic Sun, you've got Summit, you've got Sun Belt continuing, Horizon continuing, Northeast, and you know, down the line. And then by Thursday, you got a handful more. And by the weekend, you're in full swing there. And a great time of the year. So these conference tournaments are fun. We had Kevin O'Neill on right before the conference tournaments last year. And we had a bunch of good thoughts and interesting ways to look and how to bet those outrights. And those are fun, too, because you get long shots. And, hey, long shots, I remember last year was a lot of chalk. But in a 3-4-game sample, you can get crazy things to happen and get some of these long shots home. So maybe we'll try to have Kev on or somebody to talk college hoops for the Monday show. But the story, at least for now, UConn, what a statement. I can't get a grip on this team. I thought a few weeks ago, you know what, there's the value on them, good out of conference. They're in a little bit of a – they're not in a slump, but they weren't impressive for a little stretch in conference play. I thought there was value on them. And then they lost to Creighton. I kind of just mentally given up on them where, you know what, they lost as a 15-point favorite. Every night they don't cover. They just don't look like a championship team. And then they played a pretty good game against Villanova Saturday. Only allowed like 5 made shots in the second half until garbage time, the last like 3 minutes of the second half. Then Nova hit a couple shots in garbage time. But really played good defense. And then on Wednesday night, doesn't beat St. John's, doesn't just get revenge on St. John's. They embarrass St. John's and run them out of the building 72-40. And one of the craziest box scores play-by-play you're ever going to see. St. John's made a shot with 17 and a half minutes left in the game, so 2.5 minutes in to the second half, and never made another shot the entire game. UConn could have not scored in the second half and still won the game. The famous UConn 30-0 run against Illinois in the Elite Eight a couple years ago, if St. John's had one of those, they still would have lost by a couple points. I mean, the stats are just incredible. To go that long, to go 17-28 without a field goal. This is a good St. John's team. I think they're not perfect. They've got some flaws, kind of a weird roster, a weird, you know, style of play. They try to do it with offense and offensive rebounding and, you know, toughness and size. But it's still a really good team. It's still a team that if they won a couple games even more in the tournament, you wouldn't be surprised if they made Sweet 16, Elite Eight. A Final Four would seem like a stretch, but you get the idea. It's still a really good St. John's team, and UConn just embarrassed them. Maybe this is the turning point of UConn throwing their hat back in the ring with the Michigans, with the Dukes, the Arizonas. You got to put Florida in there now. So we'll see here with UConn. They can really shoot it. They played incredible defense on Wednesday night. They're now 14-1 to win the title. I think they got to as high as like 20-1 after the loss to Creighton. Probably wasn't a bad number to grab. But again, at the time, it looked like you're probably just kidding yourselves to living off past reputation. It's not really that team, all that sort of stuff. But right now, Michigan, the short shot, plus 350. Duke, plus 450. Arizona, 5-1. Florida down to 9-1. Florida's playing incredibly well. They were down 3 to Texas, and Texas getting 7.5 at closing that game. Texas is up 3 with like 6 or 7 minutes left, getting 7.5. And they didn't cover. They didn't come close to covering. I think it was a 21-3 run by Florida to end that game on Wednesday night. So Florida's just been dominant here. If their guards hit shots, they're going to be really hard to beat with their size. Yeah, so Florida's now the fourth short shot. Houston 10-1, Illinois 11-1, Connecticut at 14-1, as well as Iowa State, and then you get into the Kansas Purdue's of the world, 22-1 and longer. But I think UConn's got a good shot here for the last one seed, which I would not have said a week ago. I thought they're just not going to get enough quality wins. You know, the Big East isn't good enough. The loss to Creighton probably finished them for a one seed. But if you look at the prediction markets, Cal-State has them over minus $2 to be the last one seed. And some of it is these other teams have lost. You know, Houston's lost three in a row. That knocks them down. Illinois had losses. Iowa State lost to BYU. And remember, UConn has a really good non-conference. They beat Illinois. They won at Kansas. They beat BYU, which was a good win. And they did beat Florida. So keep that in mind. If it's close, and that could be the battle for the last one seed, UConn versus Florida, that head-to-head, sort of similar to a Notre Dame versus Miami, that head-to-head from a while ago could come back around here to give UConn that final one seed. And something I've talked about, too, one of those regionals is in Houston. You can't give Houston. If Houston's a 2 or 3, you can't give them home court advantage. It's got to be a reward for home court. And even that in the tournament, you could argue, is that fair or not? But you can't give Houston, if they're a 2 or a 3, and punish a team that's better than them for a better regular season and make them play a road game in the Elite Eight. That would not be fair, or even the Sweet 16. So we'll see how that plays out. I wouldn't think the committee would do that, but they want to sell tickets. They want to sell tickets. And that's one of the things about this tournament. I don't think people realize everyone loves the tournament. You love to watch it, but it's hard to sell tickets to it. It doesn't always fill up these buildings because it's random teams in random locations. People want to stay home and watch the games. So, I mean, fans will travel for it, but it's not as easy to sell tickets, I think, as some people might think. So, but that would be unfair if they gave Houston home court with a 2 or 3. But I think UConn's now a leg up, I would say, probably to get the final one seed, because it's hard to see them losing again with their schedule. These other teams probably going to knock themselves off. And I guess if Florida ran the table and won the SEC, it'd be a conversation. But you look at UConn's schedule, home against Seton Hall and at Marquette. I mean, you should win both those games. And unless you got picked off in the conference tournament, and look, they just lost as a 15-point favorite to Creighton. It's possible, but that's in MSG. They're going to have a nice support there. You'll probably meet up with St. John's at some point again, and based on how Wednesday night went, it's hard to pick St. John's. So I think UConn, I think they control their own destiny in all likelihood for the final one seed, which would make the one seeds Michigan, Arizona, UConn, and Duke. And boy, this is going to be a hell of a tournament. I keep saying it. The upsets won't be there. It's going to be chalky, but this is going to be a hell of a tournament with some of these teams. Some of these teams are really good. I mean, if you ever got that as a Final Four, like Michigan versus UConn, and Duke versus Arizona, something like that. I mean, those are awesome, awesome matchups, awesome games. Florida right in the mix. Really, really good teams. And I can't wait to get it going here. We'll talk baseball with Jensen in a minute. I did add one bet. I don't think I've talked about it on here yet. I talked about it with Bear on Sunday. Odds for the worst record, odds for the fewest wins. I'll get Jensen's thoughts here in a minute. I know Bear threw out the Twins at 35-1. To me, the Nationals at plus 750 at DraftKings, that's a good bet. The Rockies might actually be a little better. I know Michael Lorenzen and Quintana are not like Cy Young contenders, but they're both former All-Stars. They're both respectable arms. You throw in Sagano, who is, his underlying stuff's really bad. He might get rocked in cores, but these are guys that can at least make their pitching staff competitive, and they're minus 400. I don't know that they're going to have the worst record. There's certainly no value on the minus 400. To me, the Nats at plus 750, awful bullpen. They had the worst bullpen ERA last year. Their starting rotation is just awful. Brad Lord and Miles Michaelis and Cavalli's got some ability, but looks like he might be their number one. Josiah Gray coming off injury, he's not bad either, but boy, that's a tough division, and it's not as unbalanced as it used to be, but you still get the Mets, the Phillies, and the Braves a whole bunch of times, and throw in the Marlins, who have some pitching. They always develop arms, were feisty last year. They have an underrated lineup. The Nationals at plus 750, to me, are worth a shot for worst record. I think they're going to be right in the mix. 66 wins last year. The White Sox have shorter odds at 7-1. The White Sox are not that bad. White Sox could have won, probably should have won 70-something games last year with their the run differential. They've got a lot of good young players. Now, the Nationals have some young players, too. Dylan Cruz and some of these guys, I get that. I don't like that team, and I think that's a tough division. And I think the Rockies could be better to the point where it's at least competitive between them and the Nats. I know, like, Bear threw out Minnesota at 35-1. Seems like a stretch that they would get all the way to the bottom with their team. I get it. You could sell off players. Guys could get hurt. But actually finishing with the fewest wins, they are getting 35-1. So you're getting paid for the long shot there, paid for the unlikelihood. But it does seem like a stretch. I like the value at Washington plus 750, and shop around, you might find a better number than that. So College hoops coming down the stretch. Conference tournaments start on Monday. We turn the calendar to March on Sunday, and then away we go with these conference tournaments. So fun time of the year. Let's talk some baseball. Jensen Lewis, his favorite bets. Story time from pitching to A-Rod and Manny and all of his years in the major leagues. That is next. This Should Have Bet More podcast. All right, we are back. Should Have Bet More podcast. You can catch him in the morning. VSiN by the book, 7 to 10 Eastern. MLB Network Radio, former Major League relief pitcher, Jensen Lewis. Jensen, what's up, man? Spring training is here. Season, you can smell it. You can taste it. What's going on?
Good to be with you, buddy. We get the added element of WBC, World Baseball Classic here. Pool play starting next week. So excited to see not only where we get for that competition off the heels of the Americans winning the gold medal in men's hockey, but also added opportunity for youngsters in camps across a lot of teams to be able to show what they can do.
You know what? Let's just start there because I have not dug into it too much. I got to do a hit next week where I have to talk about it, so I've got some homework to do on it. What do you look? Is there anything bettable in this WBC? It's tough for me because, man, the pitchers, there's rules about how many innings they're going to throw, and a lot of these guys are just cameos, which I completely understand. You don't want to ramp it up too early and throw these intense games this early in the season. So odds to win it, MVP. Game by game, anything you're looking at from a betting standpoint.
Sure, and there's four pools, A, B, C, and D, for people that are not familiar, five teams in each pool. The top two teams in each pool will qualify for the quote-unquote knockout round there in the quarterfinals. Team USA, easy one there in Pool B. They are, I believe, a $100 favorite to qualify. No surprise with Brazil, Great Britain, Italy, and Mexico. Mexico just got some tough news that a couple of their star players will not be able to participate due to insurance reasons. So unless there are just monumental issues with the United States, they will be into the knockout round. I would say from a future standpoint, Will, I would look to the quote-unquote group of death or pool of death, and that's Pool D with the Dominican Republic, with Venezuela, Nicaragua, the Netherlands, Israel. If you're not looking at betting Team USA or Team Japan to win it all, I would say a look at the Dominican Republic, Venezuela, anything around 4-5-1 for the DR, maybe upwards of 8 or 9-1 for Venezuela. It feels like on that side of the bracket, so Pool A and Pool B will play each other in the knockout rounds. C and D will play each other. So basically it's Japan up against either the DR or Venezuela. And I would think something would have to go really wrong too if Puerto Rico doesn't come out of their own pool, which will be in San Juan. So they'll have the home field advantage there. That would be who I would expect would be the primary contender to try and knock the United States out.
Are you into this? Do you enjoy it? Is it for me, it's like, it's March Madness is going on. If it was going on now, if it was going on the last couple of weeks, where it's kind of the dead zone in the sports calendar where there's not much going on, I'd be into it. And I feel like the first couple of years of it, I remember back in like 2000 and I want to say 2009 when they did it, it was a little earlier. It was in that dead spot of February. And there's just a lot of open real estate there from a sports perspective. But how much of this will you be watching? How into it are you?
Yeah, the baseball part of me will, because it's elevated competition. It's not spring training where you're going through the reps and you're just getting yourself ready to play for a season. You're playing with the country that you want on your chest there. And so you'll see it. If you've not watched, for people who haven't, make sure you watch the pool in Miami, because it feels like it is a Latin American party every single game. It feels like a soccer game at a baseball stadium. It is really great theater. Those guys, to a man, will talk about winning this title, whether you're from Puerto Rico or the Dominican or Venezuela. They take more pride in winning this tournament than they do a World Series. So that gives you perspective where we have a four nations with hockey, and what we just saw in the Olympics, that's how much it means to those guys internationally.
Ultimately, what'd you end up landing on in terms of bets? Do you have bets in the account?
I don't have anything yet. I do want to see finalized rosters because, again, we're still getting issues. Cuba just found out that they have had issues with visas with guys trying to get stateside here. So once we get to pool play, which for people marking the calendar, that does begin in the middle of next week, I believe March 4th, that first day of pool play. That'll be Chinese Taipei and Australia from the Tokyo Dome. That'll be a one to watch, and then we'll kind of see early next week. By the books, we'll have a little breakdown on Monday of maybe some actionable spots.
All right, Major League Baseball. We had you on a month or so ago, but Let's just let's dive back into it. I will give you the floor. Your strongest opinion of any of the 30 teams is what? What team are you have the most conviction on?
I would say that I really do like the Pirates and to make the playoffs and Connor Griffin to win the MVP. This is something I identified months
rookie
and months
of the year,
ago. Yes, a rookie of the year. Thank you.
MVP would be good too.
That would be amazing. Yes, it would be absolutely amazing. So NL Rookie of the Year, I think for him, because we air a lot more, Will, on position player side because of the games that they get to play and with pitchers. You know, sometimes you don't get that full leash to be able to accumulate enough of an impact there to kind of overwhelm what a position player could give you. I would also look at J.J. Weatherholt, too, in that market for National League Rookie of the Year. The Cardinals are going to be bad. He's got a chance to make the team out of camp, and he will be a dynamic player for them. I would marry the Pirates' conviction with the Seattle Mariners. I do feel like they've got everything they need to get back, not only to the ALCS, but to punch their ticket to the World Series for the first time in franchise history. You and I talked Orioles to win the East the last time we did it. Nothing has dissuaded me from really liking that. I think the American League East is the most balanced division in all of baseball. I would not shy away from the Braves injuries either to their rotation. I still think that their offense has got a lot in the tank. I think they're going to surprise some people there. And then in the Central, I know a lot of people like the Tigers. I am really not convinced yet on their offense. Something is sticking with me about their downfall, not only in the second half, but it evaporated for them in September. Will they get off to the ridiculous start they did in April and May just a year ago? Can they do it again this year? Regression is an issue. And I'll throw one back to you. Where do you stand in the Brewers? Because even after the Freddie Peralta trade, that is a really damn good pitching staff, top to bottom. They need to stay healthy. Speaking of regression, can they get enough offensively from what they did last year? I don't think they win 97 games. I don't think anywhere near that. But, man, it still feels like they are a team you constantly overlook, yet they overperform.
Yeah, don't want to doubt them. I mean, I do think last year they they just kind of met their match. It reminded me when they played the Dodgers in the playoffs of, like, in college hoops, sometimes a Cinderella runs into, like, Duke or something, and it's like, all right, this is not a fair fight. One team just has much better players, but I'm not betting against them. I'm not betting they're under. It would be over or past just respect for the franchise, respect for the infrastructure.
Yeah, 84.5. I'm with you. I know for our VSiN betting guide, I did go under just because I felt the offense would regress. I think people might be sleeping a little bit on the Cubs offseason on the pitching side. The back end of their bullpen, a boatload of reinforcements for them. I'm anxious to see the health of their rotation. You get Bregman in there. He's a proven winner on the offensive side. I actually think it's a better spend for them to get Bregman and not re-sign Tucker. I think the Cubs are going to be a very formidable team.
The worst team, the Rockies. I don't know if you saw this market. Fewest wins. Rockies are minus 400. If you look back at last year, and we all know they were bad, but man, 43-119, 50 games out of first, 40 games out of a playoff spot, minus 424 in runs. They were awful. That being said, you had Jose Quintana, Michael Lorenzen. Sagano's probably going to get lit up in that ballpark, but those are at least major league arms. They can raise the floor and maybe they're not the worst team this year, or are they still just clearly the worst team? Or do you have anyone else in mind?
I think the Nationals would be the team I would bank on. Yeah, I think they're in contention for it. I'll give you two really big long shots. Anxious to see what happens with the Twins now with the Pablo Lopez injury. I don't know what to expect. I mean, you want to talk about a team that will routinely get various injuries to star players year in and year out. It feels like it's been the Twins. Byron Buxton finally stayed healthy last year. What do you get from Royce Lewis? I don't know, and I'm a little leery of where the Twins could be. If it starts bad, you know, do they have anything to really right the ship? That's a team on a long shot side. The Rockies, I actually am a little bit more bullish on their over win total, and it's what, 52.5 somewhere. It doesn't feel like that's a lot for them to get to. Hunter Goodman showed me a lot last year. I think if you're looking for singular season-long player props, love him for 30 or more home runs. Obviously getting 81 home games there in Colorado, another year better. I think that would be a guy to look at. Only other team I would throw in there, and it's just because with injury issues that they've experienced, they are going back to their home. The Tampa Bay Rays are going to be better. But if it does become an issue where that offense doesn't have anything behind Diaz and Caminero, The back end of their lineup, I don't know about you, but in the East, that's not really good to turn over. Gavin Lux comes in and probably be their leadoff guy. Their rotation is going to have to get the absolute most out of Drew Rasmussen, out of Ryan Pepiot. What do you get from Shane McClanahan? Can they pitch and stay in it? Probably. But if you're looking for super long shots, maybe the Rays for most losses.
All right, I'm in the Northeast. Let me just get you a thought and just a win total, an exact number of wins for each one of these teams. The Yankees win how many games?
I'm going to go 92. I think they're going to get a lot of reinforcement with Rodon and with Gerrit Cole. I'm not happy to hear that Giancarlo Stanton has trouble opening a bag of chips right now. That is a pretty big issue. They're running it back here. I just think they have way too much depth in the rotation not to at least get 90 wins.
The Mets win how many games?
91 for me, but I won't be shocked if they don't get to 90 because I still think there are question marks for them. And that rotation, while it could look deep on paper, you are still asking Clay Holmes to stay healthy. Could I Senga to stay healthy? Can David Peterson get close to what he did last year? Sean Manaea, that's a wild card. I have more questions about their rotation. Don't have as much about the offense, but the defense. Will, you're going to be holding on for dear life as a Mets fan if you get a ball smoked down the third baseline or the first baseline and you're asking Bo Bichette and Jorge Polanco early in the season to try and make plays in a tight game. If I'm a reliever, oh, man, I'm trying to generate as much swing and miss as possible so nothing is put in play on the ground.
The Red Sox, how many wins?
I like them for at least 88, and I think if they get off to a great start, I was just looking at their schedule. They open in Cincinnati and then in Houston, and they're back home for a gauntlet in April. Their month of April is really, really tough. They'll have the Detroit Tigers for four games, and I think it's like three straight AL East series for them. So they're a unique club, but they did enough, I think, in the rotation to get themselves right. Question being, can you really bank on Roman Anthony leading you from the leadoff spot, Trevor Story doing what he did last year, Wilson Contreras offensively, I think, will be fine with the Green Monster. I'm going to say at least 88. I think they could surprise some people.
Do the Dodgers do what they did last year and kind of pace themselves and load manage and just, hey, see you in October? I know they're at 103.5. I know it's dangerous to bet against them because all of that talent, but to me, it would be under nothing. Where do you stand with the Dodgers?
That's a play for me. Absolute under. It was under 104.5 for me last year. I'll go right back to the well. You nailed it. It's not about the regular season for them. They didn't even have the entirety of their rotation healthy until September. And then, you know, it was like, okay, let's hit the gas and we're good to go from there. Remember also, Will, their bullpen last year on paper to out of spring training was supposed to be one of the best. It was one of the worst. I mean, trying to get games across the line for Dave Roberts, he aged about 10 years through the regular season last year, so anxious to see how that works too.
Any awards? I know with MVP it's tough because it's just so heavily for Judge, for Ohtani. Do you think anyone outside of those two is live or worth a bet for MVP?
So I talked about the National League side and four names that if you want more value, I think are worth it. Ellie De La Cruz was a guy last year. If he doesn't have, you know, the power drop off or like it just evaporate from him in the second half, maybe he's alive. I think he needs at least 40 homers, at least 50 steals, and the Reds have to be in contention for the National League Central and at least firmly in the postseason race. I do like Fernando Tatis Jr. for the Padres. I have no clue what to expect from them overall, though. God knows what we could get. They could be really good or they could be just really bad. And with the ownership issues and the payroll issues, you know, this could be an interesting season for AJ Preller and what he does there. Two other names, Ketel Marte, obviously with what Geraldo Perdomo did for them. He's in such a juicy spot hitting in between Perdomo and Corbin Carroll. And then two guys with hamate injuries. Originally, I wanted Corbin Carroll. That hamate injury is going to be a problem, although hitting in Arizona will be fine. And I do, if you're going for the Mets, Francisco Lindor is still a guy to look at. He's got to have the hamate issue too. So those would be two guys in Lindor and Carroll I wouldn't be as high on because of the initial injury, but Ellie De La Cruz, Fernando Tatis Jr., and I think Ketel Marte worth a look.
How about Cy Young? Any sleeper for Cy Young?
God, if Jacob deGrom stays healthy, not really a sleeper, okay? That's a guy that when he's right, I don't know if there's anyone better from the right side. If you're looking for sleepers, maybe on either side, I think you can probably get into maybe the American League West again, and someone in the Seattle rotation not named Brian Wu or Logan Gilbert. It just from a ballpark standpoint, you know this. I mean, you just got all the benefit of the doubt there, and you got a chance to really limit some offenses. So I don't know. I don't know if there's anyone I want to really go to outside of DeGrom at that number. I mean, Eovaldi, I guess, in that rotation at a higher number. But again, you're working with health issues there from both those guys.
And you're high on Texas this year, right? I think talking to you last time, I think Gore being around DeGrom, being around Eovaldi, the work ethic, just, hey, I throw this pitch in that count, I grip this ball that way. You know how some of these veteran pitchers that are really, you know, great, and DeGrom's a Hall of Famer, I would think, especially based on, you know, talent.
Okay.
We'll see if you got the winning, the innings, et cetera. But that can rub off. But where are you with Texas? Disappointed a lot of people last year.
For sure. Wyatt Langford's got to be right. If he's – they'll go as far as he goes. And even with Seager, if Seager can stay healthy too, I love that dynamic. You just gave me two ideas. Long shots – in the American League Cy Young and the National League Cy Young. Cade Horton for the Chicago Cubs. At one point before he got hurt in the second half, Will, he was as good as any starting pitcher in the National League. So Cade Horton, super long shot. Jack Leiter actually might be worth a look. You talk about how DeGrom and Eovaldi being around those guys, that is very, very high risk, high reward. He would need to be the ace of that rotation ahead of DeGrom. But if you're looking for pure upside and stuff, he's a guy worth a triple-digit look.
Wow, I hadn't thought of that one. And he was so highly touted, you know, coming out of the draft, and him and Rocker, and I don't know where you stand on both of them. But Leiter showed flashes, was better at times last year. It's interesting to hear you say that, though.
Yeah, again, just the not expecting that to be anywhere right. close initially, but you could see where the narrative would go. Ballpark that he pitches in, you're going to have to neutralize some offenses there in the American League. Horton, I think, is one that if you really want to buy some stock, that one could really come down in a hurry.
Before you go, I don't think I've asked you this. Who is your least favorite hitter to face in Major League Baseball?
Oh, Kevin Youkilis, own me. It was 7-for-11, I think. That Coke bottle that's no longer over the Green Monster. And again, they put in the Monster seats there years ago. 2007, in Game 7 of the ALCS, I came in to finish Game 7 for us in the bottom of the eighth, and he hit a solo homer I joked exploded the Coke bottle. That's why it's not there anymore. He, for what I could have thrown underhand, overhand, side, didn't matter. He owned me. Guys on the flip side, though, A-Rod 0-for-4. Big Poppy 0-for-9 against me, too, with a handful of strikeouts. So I got the guys that I should have gotten most of the time, and your Hall of Famers, things of that nature, they took care of business.
How did you pitch A-Rod?
A-Rod was fastballs. I elevated late. Actually, my best inning ever, Will. I don't think we've talked about this. Game 3 of the American League Division Series in 2007, eighth inning, struck out Jeter, Bobby Abreu, and Alex Rodriguez. And I can remember I threw a cement mixer slider on – it was a 2-1 pitch, I think, to A-Rod. And I, you know, as soon as you let it go, you're like, oh, God, it's not coming back. He fouled it straight back. And I kind of breathed a sigh of relief. I think next pitch was 96 at the letters. He swung right through it. I came in the dugout, sat down, and Paul Byrd came over and kind of sat next to me and goes, do you realize what you just did? I said, yeah, and we got three outs. He goes, no. You struck out a future Hall of Famer, maybe two future Hall of Famers, and maybe the best right-handed power hitter going right now. And I'm like, yeah, okay. That's back when you had, like, the flip phones and you had to text, you know, the number multiple times to get the letter that you want. I had, like, 100 text messages and 50 voicemails. It was surreal, man. Just an unbelievable atmosphere in old Yankee Stadium.
When you're facing somebody like A-Rod, is it any other guy? Is it just something where you know how great he is and it brings the best out of you and you know you have to throw it a little harder, a little sharper? Like, what is that like facing him?
That day in particular was weird because Louis Isaac, who is our bullpen coach, has a clipboard and he would read the three hitters that I was initially going to face. And Will, for whatever reason, I was not hearing him, or I was so concentrated. It was an unusually warm night. It was in the high 70s, low 80s, and I was feeling really, really good warming up. I knew I had a good heater that night. I didn't realize I had maybe the best heater of my career. And he had read it out loud. I didn't know. The only way it really started to hit was, I think it was Jay-Z's I Run New York was Jeter's walk-up song. So Victor Martinez, our catcher, had thrown down to second. I hear it start to play. And I turn around, I see him come to the plate. I'm like, oh, holy hell, this is where we are. Okay, now it's go time. And I think I hit another gear right after I struck out Jeter. And then it probably didn't matter at that point. You could have put anybody up there, and I felt like I was invincible.
What was the book on Jeter? Because we know he had that inside-out swing, take everything to right field. What was it? Was breaking balls away? I mean, a lot of the stuff is just, you know, fastballs up and in, breaking ball. The old saying, high and hard in and low and slow away. But how did, like, what was your approach and what was the book on him?
Yeah, he was a book righty for me. And the same idea you had, because he was pretty much on the plate. I wanted to try, and I was always a down and away guy. So I wanted to get strike one. And then if I was going to elevate, kind of come in, tilt him a little bit, and then just try and create some real estate either north and south or east and west. And he actually swung at a fastball high and away. That was the strikeout. And it was just a unique setup that we were able to get. Bobby Abreu always took the first pitch, so I knew that was a free one. I just poured it in there. Changeups away and down, because he was so good at going to the opposite field. And as you know, being a Yankee fan, short porch and right, do not make a mistake down and into a lefty, or it's going to get pulverized. That was another elevated fastball I got him on. And then Jeter, as I said, it was the one pitch, the slider. I wasn't a slider guy. I was a fastball changeup guy. And I don't know why Victor Martinez called it, and even more, why I didn't shake him off. I was just in the zone. And I'm like, all right, fine, I'll throw it. And was fortunate to get away with it, and then finally got the punch out in the high heat.
This is great, man. But all right, last one. I got to ask just because it's that era. So you said you did well against Ortiz. Pitching to him, pitching to Manny, what is that like? Because Manny, to me, man, for people that didn't watch him, from the time he came up, I think his first game in Yankee Stadium, hit a couple home runs. He was just a monster hitter, just like no weaknesses. What was it like facing those guys?
Manny, 2-for-3 with two homers off me, and one that I think is the one of the longest opposite field home runs in old Jacobs Field history. That was in game 4 of the American League Championship Series that year. That was part of a back-to-back-to-back. I gave up the third homer. I came in relief of Paul Byrd and gave up the third consecutive homer. That was to Manny. The unique part about Manny, Will, he was so disciplined with his scouting report, and he was looking for one pitch each at bat. If he didn't get it, he didn't take the bat off his shoulder. You could have thrown him three heaters down in the way. If he's looking for a changeup, not swinging. That's how disciplined he was. Every mistake, I mean every mistake, was a double or a homer. He didn't miss. And, yeah, he won't get in the Hall of Fame, but he should be, because it's as elite an approach and execution as anyone. I think David Ortiz probably averaged like 110 exit velo off me. He just hit it right at guys. So I felt fortunate about that. But, you know, he was also another guy right on top of the plate, tried to intimidate you, tried to take away the inside corner. And as you know, especially pitching to him at Fenway, you know, he can just kind of flip it out, how strong he was, just go off, you know, the monster, and he's got a double out of it. But those two guys were really unique in that they stayed as disciplined as anyone. They kind of looked at you and stared you down, tried to get a little read like a prize fighter, like, all right, did I really get to you there? Did you really think? And Manny was probably the best at being a fox. He was going to try and lure you into a trap. Like, he didn't see the heater away, but that's what he was looking for, and then he'd just take you to town.
That's so good. That is so good. I remember, I think it was Doug Glanville said he played against Manny in the minors, and he's playing the outfield, and Manny hits a ball in the gap, and Glanville was going to cut it off to try to hold him to a single, and he took two steps, and it was in the lights. That's how strong he was, and that's how much his ball carried.
Pretty much. And it's when you hear guys talk about it's a different sound off the bat, that is the case with prime Manny Ramirez and David Ortiz.
Jensen, this was great, man. Appreciate it. Let us know where we can find you.
Yeah, on social media, at JLew50, JLewFifty. Weekdays with Dave Ross on VSiN by the Books, 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern. Always a pleasure to be with you, man. Cannot wait to get this season underway.
All right, that will do it. Thank you to Jensen Lewis. Those were great stories. That was fun talking to Jensen. We'll be back on Monday. Rate, review, subscribe. We'll be back. See you then.